Hi, everyone. This is Tom Salemi at Device Talks. Welcome back to the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. Another great episode in your hands and your ears. I'll be talking with Joe Urban, Global President of Knees at Zimmer Biomet. Joe's got a really fascinating background, including some time spent in the surgical robotics space and also really keen on AI. And he's bringing a lot of that knowledge and insight to Zimmer's knee business. And he's got an interesting view of the future. So I know you'll enjoy that. Just before that, you'll hear from Kurt Cannon, Vice President of Endoscopy Marketing at Olympus. He's this week's FOMO. We'll talk about the rise of the ASC. And before that, we'll kick everything off with our new markers, newsmakers. This entire episode is brought to you by Cortland Biomedical, and we'll hear from Cortland a little later in the podcast. We'll sit down with Managing Editor Kayleen Brown. Before I begin this podcast, please make sure you register for Device Talks West. It's happening on October 15th and 16th at the Santa Clara Convention Center. Go to west.devicetalks.com to register. Oh, and one quick programming note. I talked with Joe Urban before the announcement that Zimmer Biomet acquired Monogram Technologies. So Zimmer Biomet did make the newsmaker, spoiler alert, but we won't be talking about Monogram in my conversation with Joe. Let's go. All right, you ready for this?
Ready.
Chris Newmarkham, how are you, sir?
Doing all right, Tom. Doing all right. We got, it's just, you know, it went from like hot around here to like October in like a day.
Yeah,
Just wild. Is it like that where you are?
Yeah, my wife was visiting a friend of hers in Colorado, in Denver, and she was amazed at how different an 80 degree temp is when it's not humid. I don't know if Minnesota's like Boston, but it probably is with all the vegetation, but it's really humid around here.
Yeah, it gets really humid here too.
So she was like, it was great. It was 80 during the day, but it was dry. And then at night it would drop to 60 degrees and the windows were open. She said it was perfect. It was
occasionally the perfect
summer. She did say that two things. One, the vegetation is browner and she likes our lush vegetation. Yeah. And two, her friend lives in a neighborhood, kind of in an older growth forest, and they went for a walk at night. And she said her friend's head was kind of on a swivel because they have like all kinds of wildlife around.
Oh, wow.
Her friend has a family of bobcats like nesting under their back deck.
Wow. That's a kitty, kitty, kitty.
Yeah, basically when they go out to the back deck, they say, hey, I'm coming out. And if they hear a growl, then they say, okay, I'll come back later. Enjoy the deck.
I just don't want to get out. I remember years ago, my wife and I did a vacation at Estes Park, and the bed and breakfast owner was like saying like, oh yeah, sometimes I have to shoo a black bear off the off the porch. You know, I just get my broom and say like, get off my porch. And like, it's like, I don't know.
A lot of people say, like, it's just, I love those people on Instagram. Like, it's just a black bear. Like, just shoo it away. I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's what I'll do. Shoo bear. Shoo.
Shoo bear. It's like, oh, come on. I don't believe you.
We were off last week and went to stayed a couple of nights at a sheep farm in Vermont.
Fun.
At the Verbo. Yeah, it was cute. It was hot, so they weren't out and about, but they were cute. But anyway, we weren't doing a Yellowstone experience. It wasn't a dude ranch with sheep or anything like that, but we pull up and the Verbo owner meets us in the driveway. He's like, well, he's like, first rule, like, don't touch the fence. It's live. I'm like, oh, okay. Well, now I want to touch it even more. Like, now I'm kind of curious. What does that feel like?
You don't want to feel that. I've heard that's like not a fun.
I will not touch the fence. I will not touch the electric fence. So anyway.
I've heard don't grab it with both hands because it could go right through your chest and that wouldn't be good. That would be very bad.
now we're going down tangent alley. When I was a kid, we had one of those school zone blinking lights near our school, and if you touch the pole and touch the nearby fence, you get a nice little current going through you. So kids being kids, we'd all like, one of us would hold the pole, we'd hold hands, the other one would hold the fence, we'd all be like, oh wow, this is, we have a live electric current going through us. The 70s.
fun with electricity.
Yeah, they didn't care if we lived or died back then. It was all good. That's why they had
one more fun wildlife story though. Is last night, I have never seen this before. Living in the Twin Cities, I saw lightning bugs in my backyard.
You've never seen that before. You don't have a lot of lightning bugs.
I mean, I have fond memories of lightning bugs when I was growing up in Ohio, and like never seeing them around here. And now, and like last night, just saw like little lightning bugs just like flashing up in the backyard. I was showing the kids. They've barely seen lightning bugs actually.
That's great.
I mean, they actually, my kids just saw lightning bugs for the first time in Wisconsin just two weeks ago. They were like totally amazed by that. You know, like and I was telling them, oh, I used to catch them and put them in jars and, you know, like, and all and they were kind of like, yeah, you know, but it's so cool. It's actually,
That's one of those things that never kind of loses. It's cool. Like when you're looking in the backyard, we have them here and you just see them. You're like, that's really neat. Like just the little flashes of light. That's really cool.
Like nature's cool. Like the little nature bugs is cool. Lights.
All right. We've weaved our way into nature is cool and not hot and sweaty. So I think Now we head into medical devices.
But they're so cool. Come on, people. All right. We can
what is number five on this vaunted list, Chris Neumarker?
Well, you know, number five on the list, we had, you know, Abbott, they posted a street beating second quarter this week, but they lowered the top end of their guidance, and the markets were not happy about that when they did this. As we're talking on Friday morning, it's recovered some today, but it's still down more than 5% for the week on that. You know, one of the most interesting things about that, their CEO Robert Ford went over some of the headwinds that Abbott's facing, but one of the things he mentioned was that you know, they're facing headwinds because of the budget cuts in the government, because Abbott provides HIV testing and the government's cut that a lot. So both at home and abroad. So that's actually a headwind for Abbott this year. So that's it's just another example of like how everything going on in Washington is affecting the companies we cover, not to mention the world at large.
Yeah, I mean, there's going to be a lot of unforeseen impacts with cuts to Medicaid and things like that. I mean, that means less healthcare. And you can debate policy this way or that, but for medtech, less healthcare is not good.
No. So. And one thing we learned during the pandemic too was, I mean, there was like, well, some of these things are things people just have to have. They're essential, even with the pandemic. You know, actually, you know, some of these things, people weren't getting things that were essential that they really needed during the pandemic at some points. And, you know, you get Medicaid cut. We'll see if some of that's happening as well. Like that, you know, there are things that people seriously need that they're not getting.
I mean, we're spending a lot of time talking about the FDA and CMS, but there's other things that are impacting medtech as well. So, all right, that's interesting. Number five. Let's move on to number four.
Yeah, sounds good. Number four, we've got Medtronic. They won a CE mark to use their LigaSure sealing technology with their Hugo surgical robots. And, Medtronic's saying that this is going to, like, really expand, you know, Hugo's capabilities for all kinds of procedures in Europe, you know, from, you know, gynecologic to general to urologic. You know, positive news for Medtronic as they seek to advance Hugo, which is their big play to compete with Intuitive in the soft tissue robotic surgery space. And Hugo is presently under FDA review for a urology indication, and Medtronic's looking to enter the U.S. market, you know, later in their present fiscal year, which their fiscal years end at the end of April. So we'll keep on following this.
That's great. We'll have a little more surgical robotics news at the end of the newsmakers. Of course, this week is the Society of Robotic Surgery annual meeting in Strasbourg. Lots of news coming out of there. And next week,
lots of news.
I'll have Joe Mullings and Steve Bell on the podcast to kind of give us a post-SRS wrap-up. So
folks want
to make sure they check that out. All right, Chris Neumarker, what is number three on the Neumarker database?
Well, number three on the list, we've got Zimmer Biomet. You know, a lot of robotic surgery news this week, and, you know, I suspect, like, a lot of this is being timed, you know, with SRS that's going on out in Strasbourg. But we had Zimmer Biomet announcing that it, entered into a definitive agreement to acquire Monogram Technologies. Looks like this could be, you know, the deal could be priced at around $177 million. But Monogram develops semi and fully autonomous robotic technologies. So Zimmer Biomet has their, you know, line of ROSA orthopedic surgical robotic systems, and they're saying that some of these technologies could complement what, the navigation, you know, and enabling technologies around ROSA. So this is kind of like a play by Zimmer Biomet to boost, you know, what it's offering through ROSA even more. And, you know, as they compete against Stryker and other companies in the space.
I don't know if you feel the same way, but with the conversations around telesurgery and now autonomous surgery, I mean, we had Andromeda Surgical at Device Talks Minnesota, an AI conversation where certainly we talked a lot about autonomous surgery, but it's just autonomous robotic surgery. Just seems like both telesurgery and autonomous robotic surgery have just come to the fore very, very quickly. Like,
yeah,
not even like someday we may be able to. It's more like, no, we have technology that will make this possible. So really
I
remarkable.
I think that someday we might be able to is like the 1990s. You know, I mean, I kind of recall that even just in, you know, my college days in the 90s, like seeing technology stories like, oh, we could have autonomous surgery someday. We do it over long distances. There's even some, I think it's still on YouTube somewhere. There's some like kind of like a silly video from DARPA back in the 90s where they're showing some bad cartoons. Animation of dragging a soldier into a robot thing and doing things to him, you know. But I mean, that's actually coming now. We could, you know.
That was the birth of intuitive surgical. I mean,
that was
the
birth.
Right,
that's
the
actually
start.
What that idea was what got intuitive going. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
But here we are, and you had a great discussion with Brian Miller at Intuitive about that, and they let you,
play with the Da Vinci 5 cool. and operate with Dr. Miriam Curet in Sunnyvale, and I was in Atlanta, and I'll tell you, man, it was remarkable. At a few points, I'm like, I forgot that she was 3,000 miles away. It was just that seamless. So
it's fascinating. And then you know, and I saw like Intuitive at SRS was doing that same type of demonstration, you know, to like at SRS, which is kind of cool this year because it's in Strasbourg. And, you know, there was the famous Lindbergh operation between, you know, the U.S. and France and Strasbourg, where they were operating on somebody like 20 years ago, ago.
It was 2001. You're right. I didn't put that together. And Brian Miller was there. He's with Computer Motion at the time. I don't know if that was intentional or not, the placement of it in Strasbourg. But you're right. Certainly was very cool. And
it's really cool.
Brian was great, and we'll have some video and some other content coming out of that visit to Atlanta. And but as people might have read in the article, you know, Intuitive is very much like, look, this is very cool technology, but we need to make sure that the doctors need it, and that there's a medical purpose, and that there's infrastructure around it. So,
right,
they don't say there's a long way to go, but they definitely want to, I think, tread carefully and not get ahead of clinical need or demand.
We see there can be a challenge in medtech is that there's like really cool things we could do that are technologically possible, but it's a whole other thing. Like, is just because it's you know, as a technology person, you're like, this is really cool.
Yep.
In healthcare, they're like, yeah, that sure that's cool, but we can't do anything with this.
And that's
right
why med tech is so different than other tech. Like I think about Facebook and they're like, oh, we don't know how this is going to be used, but we just know this is really cool. And we'll just, you know, basically we'll get it out there and let the world decide how it's used, and we'll follow market demand. You can't do that with med tech. Like you can't just throw something out there and say, well, let's see what doctors do with this. That's not how it works.
Let's just see what these autonomous robots do to people who get wheeled into hospitals. And we'll figure, you know.
Excuse us. They would try to take over the OR. We apologize.
I think if I was conscious and they were saying, you're going to be the first person who's going to have some cool technology used on them, I'd be a little bit like, no. As much as I love it. I like writing it. But, you know, we got to test things out and make sure it works and that there's a use for it. But at the same time, I can see, like, it helping with, especially like, you know, the fact that, I mean, there's just a wide disparity in healthcare based on where you are. I mean, we're lucky because we're right, you know, we're right in the centers of like some really innovative, you know, medical systems, you know, where we live, you know, Boston, Minneapolis. But I mean, if you're living in, you know, a more rural part of the country, you know, or somewhere, you know, a developing country somewhere in the world, you don't have access to some of this expertise.
And that's kind of the interesting difference between autonomous and telesurgery. I mean, autonomous surgical robotics essentially could bring that expertise to a remote location and allow the physicians there, whether they be interventional radiologists or interventional cardiologists or interventional neurologists, to perform multiple different sort of procedures. Whereas with the telesurgery, you're relying on the expert in whatever, New York, to reach the patient in, well, Strasbourg, we'll use the Lindbergh operation. Two very different ways to get expertise to a remote location. So I don't think there's one solution. I think we can root for them both. But you're right, they're both very important.
I think it could also be, I mean, I think one of the best uses could actually be like, I mean, even here in the Twin Cities, I mean, if you're out way out in the suburbs, like there's a difference than being like, I mean, the big centers of expertise are right in the city. So, you know, if you can have, and we have health systems that are spread across this whole area. So if you're like, oh, we don't have to take somebody from, up in like, you know, Coon Rapids or St. Cloud and bring them into the city, we can have somebody there work on them with a surgeon who is, you know, who's also got the control that can, who's got a ton of expertise who can take over and help. I mean, that's where you get some interesting stuff that could go on too. I mean,
exactly.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Let's roll on to number two, Chris Neumacher.
All right. Number two on the list. I mean, we've had BD saying they wanted to, spin off their biosciences and diagnostic solutions business. It looks like the solution they came up with was that it's going to be combining with the company Waters. It's going to be a deal worth $17.5 billion. They're seeing, BD saying this deal will expand Waters' bioseparations portfolio. It's going to combine Waters' chemistry expertise with BD's biologics expertise. So kind of getting like a new, you know, kind of this somewhat new entity here in the diagnostic space, you know, through this deal. And just kind of another example of how, you know, we're seeing a lot of kind of reshuffling going on right now. I mean, not just like acquisitions, but companies spinning stuff off.
Mm-hmm.
We're kind of through in a big period of that right now. And it's, and just to tease it, like 1 month away on medical design outsourcing, we're going to have the MedTech Big 100 report, coming out on medical design outsourcing and, you know, in early September. And that's going to be it's going to be a great chance to like really, see how the landscape is shifting, because you know there's some big changes going on, so you'd have to check it out.
Absolutely. All right. Good. Yeah, you're right. There's a good sort of resort going on in medtech, and I think we're going to be well served by having all these companies really super focused, like Solventum, spinning out of 3M.
Totally.
I think focus is an integral part or key part of success. So I think we're moving in the right direction.
Yeah.
All right. Finally, let's hit number one, Chris Neumacher.
We have news out of Johnson & Johnson related to like two of the hottest technologies right now in medtech, pulse field ablation mm-hmm. and surgical robotics. So on the PFA side, you know, we've got, you know, a update to the irrigation flow rate, you know, for the VARIPULSE PFA system. So that's some news that helps J&J continue to advance that. They've said they've now surpassed over 10,000 VARIPULSE procedures across a bunch of countries around the world. So, they're competing against Boston Scientific's VARIPULSE, Medtronic's got Pulse Select and Affera. Some positive news there, something they're doing to advance to VARIPULSE. And in the surgical robotics space, we've got news from J&J that they plan to submit the Ottava surgical robotic to the FDA for a de novo 510K clearance in 2026. So
right.
We now have a schedule. So,
well, good to see progress on part of Johnson & Johnson. We will have the head of MedTech for Johnson & Johnson, Tim Schmidt, as an opening keynote at Device Talks West. And related to your VARIPULSE conversation, we'll have Steve Mickelson, who, of course, was the founder of Farapulse and is now the head of Field Medical. He'll be at Device Talks West as well, giving his presentation. So lots of cool tech talk at Device Talks West on October 15th and 16th. So folks should join us.
Can't wait. Be awesome.
All right, Chris Neumarker, great job.
Thanks, man. Fun as always.
Always a good time, Chris Neumarker. Now let's introduce this week's Future of MedTech Opportunities. Yes, it's FOMO time. My conversation with Kurt Cannon, Vice President of Endoscopy Marketing at Olympus. Kurt, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So before we get into the question of the day, tell us a bit about yourself. How'd you find your way into the MedTech industry?
Probably like many people do. Got out of college, was looking for my first job, wanted to get into sales. And I stumbled into an opportunity with a med device company. And as I progressed from one job to the next and into more advanced med device companies, I just fell in love with not only obviously the patient care side of it, mm-hmm. but also with the physicians that you deal with every single day.
Well, Olympus is one of the leaders in medical devices, particularly in endoscopy. But we're seeing a change in the marketplace for those procedures, the rise of ambulatory surgery centers. How do you see that developing in the future? Well, first of all, what do you see is driving the push toward having more procedures done in ASCs?
I think, Tom, there's a lot of things, and one of them might actually surprise you, and it's a personal opinion of mine, but really, one is about patient convenience. Mm-hmm. Where do patients want to be seen? If you're going for, let's talk about screening colonoscopy being the most common thing done in an outpatient center from an endoscopy perspective, you're going to want to go to a place where it feels as close to home as possible. Often people are intimidated by hospitals and the hospital setting. Things seem more complex there. And it just seems more inviting when you go to an outpatient center. But in talking with physicians, what I've actually heard a lot is the physicians themselves want to have better work-life balance. Mm. The idea of efficiency used to be efficiency to do more cases. Efficiency today is about efficiency so that I can get home. So I think there's patients driving it. There's certainly reimbursement that is driving it as well. But I think you've also got physicians who are more engaged in wanting that kind of work-life balance.
It's perfectly understandable motivation. So I would think one would look at this kind of at first blush and see that whether you're selling to a hospital or selling to an ASC, the process wouldn't be much different. I'm guessing it's probably more complicated than that. How has Olympus changed its marketing toward ASCs? Or let me not assume there is a difference. Is there a difference between marketing and selling to ASCs than hospitals?
There is. You need to really understand the different business models. The hospital model, an outpatient portion of a hospital versus an actual ambulatory endoscopy center or an ambulatory surgical center. There are different business models. They have different needs on a daily basis. Their demands from an economic perspective are different because reimbursements are different by site of care. So one thing that's changed dramatically is I think companies have learned that they can't just develop a product and expect to be able to sell it to everyone the exact same way.
Interesting.
Now, certainly you can't differentiate your price point to a customer just because they're in setting A or setting B. There are rules against doing that. So you have to find other reasons and other differentiating factors as you consider what's important. So you've got the cost of service, the cost of consumables versus the cost of capital. So understanding the capital needs, operational needs of centers versus hospitals mm-hmm. is absolutely critical. So the sales person, the organization itself, you've got to have a much more dynamic approach.
So looking forward, what does Olympus see the future holding in terms of ASCs versus hospitals? Do you predict in 5 years or more that a majority of procedures will be done in one and the other? Is there a broader shift going on? What does the future look like?
Hard to say. You know, yep. One guy's opinion
is
I think you're going to see, obviously there's a rise in screening. And we've talked about that before. Early onset colorectal cancer is driving more screening procedures. Those are going to be done in an outpatient center more often than not, I believe, because of, again, the comfort level of the patient, the convenience of it is everything. But there is this talk in the market about more advanced procedures moving into the outpatient setting as well because mm-hmm. of the convenience of it. There's also an efficiency. So if you look at endoscopic ultrasound and doing some of those procedures outpatient, even an ERCP procedure has been discussed. How do you do that in an outpatient setting? The efficiency comes from keeping your physicians in one location. instead of a physician having to do all of their screening work or more general work at an outpatient center, and then they've got to get in their car, drive to the hospital, wait in the hospital for the inpatients to come in, the inefficiencies there slow down their day. Well, what if I kept them in the center? What would that look like? Mm-hmm. Could they do more procedures in the same amount of time and still get home and have that work-life balance? So there's so many different factors there, but I do think you're going to start to see more complex procedures shifting into that outpatient setting.
And just focusing on endoscopy and colonoscopy in particular. I mean, we did talk on our Olympus Talks podcast about the push to having patients have their screening done when it should be done earlier as possible when advisable. Do you see the move toward ASCs making that a little easier? Because people have one fewer reason to kind of put it off. They don't have to go to a hospital. They can go to the strip mall up the street or wherever the ASC is located.
Yeah, I think that's possible. The other factor that we have as a limiting factor is the number of endoscopists to perform screening. There already aren't enough today. Current trend is that we lose more to retirement than we bring in through fellowship.
Okay.
So we somehow have to reverse the trend of physicians doing endoscopy. The additional screening efforts and the other fit tests, et cetera, that bring in more potential positive results, those people then end up needing a colonoscopy. So additional screening is fantastic because we're going to reach the people that won't get a colonoscopy for whatever personal reason. But eventually, if they have a positive result, they're going to need a colonoscopy. And now you're bringing them into the exact same backlog that we already have.
Interesting.
COVID taught us a lot about, I think, the backlog that can occur with screening colonoscopy.
Interesting. All right. Well, it's a fascinating future. ASCs are certainly going to be a big part of it. And thanks for sharing your thoughts today on the future of MedTech.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thanks.
All right. It's great to hear from Kurt Cannon of Olympus. Now I will hand the microphone over to Device Talks Managing Editor Kayleen Brown for a message from our sponsor, Cortland Biomedical.
Michelle Lishner, textile engineer for Cortland Biomedical, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So you are my first textile engineer, but I'm really excited to share your passion and what Cortland Biomedical does with our audience. Can you tell us about Cortland Biomedical?
Absolutely. Cortland Biomedical is a trusted partner in custom biomedical textiles. Today, we support the next generation of healthcare by providing custom biomedical textiles. We've expanded into knitting and weaving. We manufacture in ISO 7 and 8 cleanrooms and provide textiles to a whole array of different medical device markets, including cardiovascular, robotic surgery, and of course, orthopedics. We are a pretty curious group. We like to be agile in R&D and really help our orthopedic OEM partners get their product to market.
I'm always intrigued with how you work together with medical device companies. So does Cortland Biomedical have a specific model when working with medical device companies?
One of my favorite things that we do is invite the customer to our facility in upstate New York. We welcome them into our clean rooms. We do rapid prototyping in real time. We have whiteboard brainstorm sessions, and we really value that level of transparency and responsiveness with our customers. We're also an ISO 13485 certified finished component manufacturer. So we are set up to deliver consistent quality all the way from prototyping to scale-up and validations through commercial production. And at the end of the day, being a custom manufacturer, we really focus on what matters the most to our customers. If it is technical performance, we will meet you there. If it's a cost improvement effort, we will dial into that. Transparency, collaboration, and responsiveness is at the heart of everything we do.
I love that so much, Michelle. We're going to take a really quick break from my conversation with this episode's sponsor, Cortland Biomedical, to bring you our keynote interview with Joe Urban, president of Zimmer Biomet's knee business. Now, I know you're excited to learn more about Cortland Biomedical, so don't wait. Visit their website at cortlandbiomedical.com. That's Cortland biomedical.com. And now, Joe Urban.
Well, Joe Urban, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be here. Appreciate you having me.
My pleasure. I always like to take time unpacking a person's story before we get into talking about the company. And I do want to get to that in a moment because you've got a really interesting background. But when I opened up your LinkedIn profile, I was struck by how many LinkedIn followers you have. You have a pretty big audience. Is that, I don't see that all the time from executives. Is that, was that a priority of yours or did it just happen?
Actually, I have about 20,500 followers, give or take. And about 6 years ago, I made it a conscious effort to increase the followership I had. Back then, I think it was under 1,000, and it was just a dedicated effort and consistent posting where I was just focused on driving the followers and just saw LinkedIn as a great tool for that.
Has it had its benefits? I asked because I did a conversation recently with someone about whether executives should be active on LinkedIn and creating, getting a lot of followers. And I think it's a form of leadership. I think it's important. I wonder if it's how well it served you since you focused on that.
Here's how I see it. I see it as a way to communicate the vision of what problem you're trying to solve. So like at Zimmer Biomet, for me, it's a platform where people are passively watching and observing what Zimmer Biomet's doing as an example. And it's a good way to communicate with everything from potential employees to surgeon customers, facilities, everybody. And so I see it as a way to just really communicate what we're doing and just get the word out there. So for me, I see LinkedIn as an incredible tool. And your presence has been also well noted. And I've enjoyed following you over the years. And it's just been great to see what you've built.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I'm trying to catch up to you, though. I'm only at 18,200. So I'm eager to get to that 20K mark. So I can't wait to join you in that lofty territory. But all right, enough about LinkedIn. Let's talk a bit about your background. Where did your career start? You were captain in the U.S. Army. Was that your initial? Did you grow up and leave high school and go into college with a career in the Army in mind?
It's a great lead in. So I was at Colorado State University. And I was in student government and also the U.S. Army. And I loved every minute of it. At Colorado State, I was the student body president and I was set to go to law school. I was going to be a lawyer.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And just one thing happened and I was recruited by the Ernest and Julio Gallo Winery. And I went to work for the E&J Gallo Winery and their management development program straight out of school. I was a full ride scholarship cadet in college. And so but it was during the drawdowns in the mid 90s. So okay. They're drawing down the Army and they gave everyone an option. Do you want to go active or reserve? And I thought I could always go back and join as an active duty officer. And I'll get to that in a second because I had my opportunity in Afghanistan to be active duty.
Oh my gosh.
And what I chose was to go and give it a shot to work for the Gallo Winery. I thought it was a great opportunity and it turned out to be a fantastic opportunity. I was there for about 5 years, was recruited to the Boston Scientific Endourology Division. And what was interesting is that approximately at the time, a quarter of their employees came from the Gallo Winery.
I was going to say, it's a big feeding system. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Huge, huge feeding system. But Boston's profile was consumer packaged goods, sales management, just experience with the actual sales training. And so I went to work for the Boston Scientific Endourology Division. And about 6 months after I started, 9/11 happened. And 6 months after that, I had my orders to go to Afghanistan. So I went to Afghanistan. Boston Scientific was incredible to me while I was gone.
Wow.
And just a great company and treated me right. And so I went to Afghanistan as a Army officer focused on psychological operations. There's not a lot of PSYOP soldiers that are in the active duty. So we were one of the first to get called up, and I was all over the country back in 02 to 03.
Wow.
And so that was the introduction to MedDevice, and I've had the great opportunity to work for some wonderful companies over the years, learn a ton, and also worked with some incredible innovators over the years.
So you were there in the very early days. Did you have plans to go back into medtech? And when you joined the Gallo Winery, this is a combined question. Did you know that it was a feeder system for the medtech industry? And was
I had
that
no
your
idea? I had no idea. And I kept getting calls from from Boston Scientific and other companies within MedDevice. And then I had a friend that went over there and just got more serious around the late 2000s, early 2001. And that's when I joined Boston, was in 01. It was not I did not go to work for the Gallo Winery because I knew it was a feeder system, but it turned out to be a great decision to forget law school and go to the Gallo Winery, because it led me to my true passion, which is MedDevice. I love this industry. It's just been fantastic. I feel like we can truly impact people, and I've seen it from a personal standpoint, and it's something that gets me up every single day and charging out the door. So it's a fantastic time.
And we had Steve Mappa from MedTech Vets on about five or six weeks ago from the airing of this, talking about sort of the overlapping mission. Well, not the missions aren't the same, but the passions and having a mission are the same for MedTech and for the armed services. Do you find that, and do you work with vets, or have you engaged with any vets who have been looking to the medtech industry? I'm just wondering what your feeling is about the synergy between the two.
It's a fantastic question, and it's something that I know that the industry could do more with. The folks that I worked with in the U.S. military, and we worked with every branch of the service, they're very, as you can imagine, mission focused, and they're looking, when they exit the military, they're looking for something that will fill that mission centric mindset that they've had for so many years. And so I think from a fit, MedTech gives them exactly that. If you can find the right fit, the person will come in and do very well. And so I've been very close with the folks from MedTech Vets, to include like Derek Herrera. I don't know if you know him. Bright Euro, wonderful person, a good personal friend. Within Zimmer Biomet, we have a major focus on veterans. It's a consistent reminder from the top all the way across, diagonal every direction, on the veterans that work for Zimmer Biomet. There's a feeling of gratitude that's expressed consistently, not just on Memorial Day and Veterans Day, but a number of touch points throughout the year. And there's a lot of veterans that work for us, and we do have a program that enables that onboarding of veterans. And I think it's wonderful. I wish more companies had a program like Zimmer Biomet have, where we have a significant number of veterans. And I know that the veterans that we have great employees, are good drivers, and they understand the mission that we have to alleviate pain around the world. And so for us, it's been a wonderful thing.
That's fantastic. Well, let's get into your MedTech background. As I joked at the start of the year, I could spend the whole episode just talking about your background, but you've been at C.R. Bard. You were director of global marketing of interventional urology. You were at Auris Surgical Robotics. You were at Asensus Surgical before that. So you found your way around the medtech industry in surgical robotics, different types of technologies. Did you have an intentional plan to have a broad sampling of different medtech markets and technologies, or is this just sort of the way your story played out?
A little bit of both. I wanted back in the mid 2000s, I wanted some experience with startups, and that the entrepreneurial growth that I felt like I could get from being a part of something that was starting it from absolute scratch. And so I went early to both Endogastric Solutions. I was the first manager hired there. And then Todd Pope over at Transenterics, which is Essentious. Super early, and it was a little too early for the technology that they brought to market. It went back into R&D, and it emerged as Essentious Surgical, which became the surgical robot that was acquired by, I believe, Storz last year.
And that's so right.
It was super early. And then my time at CR Bard was another wonderful time. So Boston Scientific to start, little break in service with Afghanistan, went to a company called Spectronetics, was able to work at Spectronetics and experience that rapid growth. It's now a Philips company. It was focused on atherectomy. The startup world was great. It was during the Great Recession, so it was tough. And then ended up at CR Bard. And CR Bard was where I first met Ivan Tornos, the CEO of Zimmer Biomet. He was running Europe, and I was responsible for everything outside the United States at one point for the product portfolio of the division I was over. And I worked very closely with him with the Bard endourology portfolio and making sure that the endourology and critical care portfolio outside the United States was going, and he was managing Western Europe, and then later all of Europe. After Bard, I got a call from the guy that I worked with at Endogastric Solutions, David Schumers, who was with Fred Moll starting Auris. And he called me January of 2015 and said, "I want you to come and look at this robot. I think what we're doing is something really remarkable." I came out to the Bay and saw the robot, met with Fred, met with all the engineers, and we took a shot. We moved the family from Atlanta, Georgia to the Bay in 2015. And I was employee 53 at Auris and was able to work with some of the greatest minds on the planet, developing the next generation robotic system that ultimately was purchased by J&J for all in close to $6 billion. So it was a great, fun run and led into my role as a CEO when I went to work for Petrero. Again, working on sensor-based technologies, taking that into critical care in the OR. About a year ago, I got a call from Ivan Tornos, and he said, we're doing something special at Zimmer Biomet. And I'd been watching Ivan. We met like a couple of times over the years at JP Morgan when we'd be in San Francisco, and just caught up on life and everything else. And he shared with me that he has a very unique, special dream and vision of what he's trying to create with Zimmer Biomet. And it more than piqued my interest. To me, I looked at it and thought, this is something that's remarkable, and it's a once in a lifetime type of opportunity, where what he's doing is creating a future med tech strategic company. And Ivan always says, and I'm sure you heard him a couple of weeks ago at Device Talks, he wants to create the boldest med tech company in the world. That's pretty bold saying that. It's another thing actually doing it. And to me, Tom, that was the most appealing thing, is that we're actually doing it and impacting at scale.
That is impressive. And talk about LinkedIn presence, Von Tornos is the best.
Yeah, he doubles both of us. Just so
you know. I know that. I'm aware. So again, you were a startup of a CEO of a startup. It was in predictive health. So you wouldn't see that as a natural leap from going there to knees at Zimmer Biomet or any position at Zimmer at an orthopedics company.
You know, normally I would say you're exactly right. And where I'm convinced the future is going is where Ivan Tornos is convinced the future is going. And this is where I would say, if it was in the past saying, "Hey, why Zimmer Biomet?" It's interesting, but to do robotics, sensor-based technology, AI, you would typically have to go work for a guy like Fred Moll in the Bay Area and do it there. Yvonne Tornos has brought that future to Zimmer Biomet and into orthopedics, which has traditionally been what they call metal and plastic, and taking it from metal and plastic to a very intelligent device that helps the surgeon, their family, the patient's family, the caregiver, the payers, the facility, everybody, help that patient get better. To me, that was truly impactful to do that at scale. And so I was intrigued. It piqued my interest when Yvonne approached me and said, you have a lot of experience with sensor-based technology, you have a lot of experience with AI and robotics, and we're looking to bring all of this and coalesce it into one company, into Zimmer Biomet, and pull orthopedics into the next 20 years. And so for me, Tom, I'm convinced, and it's not just orthopedics. I know where medicine's going. It is going exactly where robotics has taken trocars, as an example. If you went back in time 25 years ago, even 20 years ago, and said that Da Vinci, the Intuitive Surgical and the Da Vinci robot would command a 200 billion plus market cap, you would have been laughed out of the room.
Right.
And you would have been laughed out of a number of big company strategics that we all know their name. They would not have taken it seriously. And so I think for me, when I looked at this and I saw this opportunity of taking sensor-based technology, looking at what's happening with the patient real time, measuring it, and providing that to a clinician and to the patient so they can get better faster, that was super appealing. I'm convinced that what we're going to see is the same revolution in the evolution of medical technology that we saw in the world of laparoscopic surgery. And you saw it with soft tissue surgery from the 80s when it went from open massive incisions to little keyhole incisions to robotic, where we are today, where it just keeps getting better and better. What I think is going to happen is a traditional medical device, whether it's pick the specialty, we'll use orthopedics because that's the company I'm focused on, but I can tell you that this will happen in neurology, cardiology, cardiac surgery, structural heart, urology, general surgery, everything. And that's the integration of sensors, AI, and the ability to see. The first 20 years of orthopedics of this century were defined by robotics. The next 20-25 will be defined by processing information real time and providing that to everybody. And that's the clinician, it's the payer, it's the facility, it's the patient, it's their family, it's everybody. Giving them that granular level of data, Tom, will be where medicine is going. No question. Zero in my mind.
I'm going to push the pause button on our conversation with Joe Urban, president of Zimmer Biomet's knee business, to conclude my conversation with Michelle Lischner, textile engineer for Cortland Biomedical. For our audience who maybe wouldn't be as familiar, what are some key benefits in using biomedical textiles in medical devices?
Textiles are fully customizable. They're these highly engineered materials that are designed to repair and restore function in the body. So think braided sutures, knit, hernia repair, woven orthopedic or spinal tethers. Textiles are suitable for permanent implant and typically can be lower cost than something like a metal. And they're totally customizable. So starting with the raw material selection, we have access to the world's strongest fiber, ultra-high molecular weight polyethylene, all the way to polyesters, which are used in soft tissue anchors, to more novel, resorbable materials like PJLA or PLLA. We've even seen developments in radiopaque fibers, which allow surgeons to visualize a textile implant under fluoroscopy. So these textiles can be designed to be strong, yet thin, flexible yet low profile, which is really ideal for minimally invasive procedures. We can even do things like tailor pore size to elicit a certain cell or tissue response. So when someone asks, what are the benefits of using tech cells? Typically, my first question for them is, well, what do you need? Because there's a chance that if you can think it, we can build it, is what I like to think.
That's fantastic. It goes right back to that same mindset, you know, necessity is the mother of innovation. So if they can think it, you can likely build it. So to that point, Michelle, I know that orthopedics and the sports medicine markets are a sweet spot for Cortland Biomedical. So we talked a little bit about understanding the field, but what are some specific challenges that you're helping to solve, and what advancements are you enabling with your textile solutions?
Textiles are quite suitable for orthopedics and sports medicine. They are dependable, super strong, they're very durable. And whether it's a device for rotator cuff repair, a spinal tether, or even a tendon reconstruction, we find that advanced textile designs can really impact how the implant performs in the body. So, like I mentioned, what makes textiles so special is how customizable they are. We can design them to share load with surrounding tissue during healing. They can be low profile and delivered through smaller incisions, which is especially great because that leads to a less invasive procedure and a quicker recovery time for the patients.
I never really deep dive into not just the benefits of textiles, but the need for textiles. So this has really opened my mind. And I know that fairly recently you announced an expansion of your braiding capabilities, which included a new flat and round braider, which is hugely important for orthopedics and the sports medicine market. So Michelle, how are you able to help solve challenges that the orthopedic companies may have when they're designing a product for an application like a tendon or a ligament repair? Mm-hmm.
At Cortland, we are always looking at how orthopedic procedures are evolving and then taking a look at where we can invest in new technologies that support that. So with our recent expansion, we are responding directly to trends that we're seeing in the orthopedic and sports med markets. For example, for flat sutures and suture tapes, we've noticed that those actually provide clinical performance benefits. So typically, we like to say that they have better load distribution on soft tissue once they're implanted. I like to think of the combination of our expansion and our new technologies with our existing talent really gives orthopedic OEMs a lot of design freedom and confidence.
If you don't mind, just can you summarize what is Cortland Biomedical's core mission?
We are agile by approach, very curious in nature, and we're credible through the decades of experience that we have starting the braiding department. We look forward to supporting the next generation of healthcare with biomedical textiles.
Oh, I hate that our time together is over, Michelle. But once again, thank you so much, Michelle Lischner, textile engineer for Cortland Biomedical. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. Thank you, thank you, thank you to this episode's sponsor, Cortland Biomedical, for sharing your story and for supporting Device Talks. We can't do what we do without you. So once again, thank you, thank you. And to our audience, Cortland Biomedical is your trusted partner in biomedical textiles. So please learn more about Cortland Biomedical and connect with them at cortlandbiomedical.com. That's C-O-R-T-L-A-N-D biomedical.com. And now for the conclusion of our conversation with Joe Urban, president of Zimmer Biomet's knee business. Enjoy.
So let's unpack what that means for your knee portfolio. I mean, we all know about the Persona sensor, but first let's get a sense of where we are. If you would give us the highlight of your portfolio, what takes up the majority of your day?
The majority of my day is focused on three categories. So there's three progressions for a knee surgery. There's a partial knee where, let's say, the inside of your knee is really starting, the cartilage is starting to wear down. If you've seen any of the posts that we've been putting up, it's around the Oxford cementless partial knee. Uh-huh. And we've worked for 20 years to get that technology into the United States. It went through a PMA process. And we now have it in the US and we're scaling it. And this to me is one of the most exciting opportunities for people, because it's a quick recovery. You preserve the ligaments and you allow somebody to get back to life faster. And it's the least invasive method for restoring mobility. And so from my perspective, I look at the results that we've seen around the world. There've been 300,000 of these surgeries with Oxford, cementless partial knee conducted around the world, 50 countries over 20 years. And the latest survivorship is around 95% at 15 years is what Professor Dodd presented. And it's, to me, that is very exciting to be bringing that to the United States with that package already done. We're not having to do a massive clinical study to show efficacy. We already have it. We are not having to say we need more data because we already have it. We have 300,000 procedures. I can't think of another time in med device where you've had that type of rollout in the U.S. where it's already been studied and there's an incredible anticipation for the technology.
What's the significance of the cementless? Why is that so critical? Yeah,
good question. So one, it cuts out 12 minutes of time. So less time to mix the cement, put the cement on, let it cure, and then to press it in. This one also has what they call osteointegration, where the bone integrates with the implant. So the bone becomes, if you will, the cement to the implant.
Okay.
And the durability of it is fantastic. There's a saying that the best day of cement is the first day. The worst day of a cementless product is the first day. It gets better over time. And so the surgeons are excited. We're training hundreds and hundreds of surgeons this year. And it's going to be a lot of fun. It will change the way that we do orthopedics, guaranteed. And the interesting thing here, Tom, the reason I think this is so interesting is everywhere else in the world, everywhere, whether it's EMEA, APAC, South America, Canada, everywhere, one in five knees is a partial knee. In the United States, it's one in 20.
Really?
Isn't that crazy?
Wow.
Yeah. So it's one of the things that you're asking, like, what I'm focused on. I'm laser focused on that. That is one area that I'm super focused on. So let's say somebody has progressed disease where there might be, out of the three compartments of the knee, two or three that have cartilage that have worn down. It's bone on bone. Those might be require a total knee. My mom has two Persona total knees they use a robot on her, the Rosa robot, and put two Persona knees in her. Her mobility is restored. This was like 3 years ago. She's doing fantastic. And it's just fun to see her do so well and to have her her life back. And so a total knee is where they'll replace the knee with two metal components, one in the tibia and one on the femur. And then in between, they have a piece of plastic that enables the knee to move back and forth, and that's called a bearing. So those three components are what replace a knee. And right now, that's the one that we're focused on with the sensor. And it's the vast majority of the knees in the United States. This is where I think we have a tremendous opportunity to help people get better. And we have the potential to really impact medicine by seeing what's happening with those patients much, much earlier. And that's what we're really working to define. And then finally, a revision. If a knee fails, like a total knee fails, it could lead to what they call a revision. And that's a more long-range, long-term solution. It's pretty invasive, from removing the old knee system that went in and replacing it with a new knee system.
Notice your mom got a Zimmer knee before you even started working at the company.
That's right. So, and that's what I tell people. She spoke at our what we call the Tidings of Joy back in December, where we bring in patients from all over the world, and she and my dad came to Warsaw, Indiana, and
awesome.
They gave their testimonial to about 8,000 people that had live streamed in, and they talked about what it meant to them as my parents, but also the grandparents to my kids and to my brother and sister and their kids, and just how much it changed their life and enabled them to live a normal retirement. And so the happiness that it's brought my mom, it became an easier decision for me as I started to look at going back to work for a big, large strategic company like Zimmer Biomet. But back to your original question, Tom, I really believe that in 5, 10, 15 years, if we were to project ourselves forward and we're at one of your device talks, I hope that you flash back to this moment on this call and you say, yeah, you know what? Joe said that the whole world was going to be different, and the way it's going to be different, and it's going to happen slow, just like robotics did, and it's going to happen extremely fast. And that is the integration of artificial intelligence, machine learning, deep learning, computer vision into the everyday life of a facility, whether it's at the surgery center, the hospital, or even in to diagnose and to communicate with their surgeons post, pre and post the surgery. I think you're going to see predictive medicine, predictive health start to kick in, where we're able to see things in the future that have yet to occur if something doesn't change. So, and I think to me, that's the most exciting thing when we take all of these populations and we start putting them together and looking at the trends and saying, we know what's going to happen if you don't intervene on X, Y, and Z. So
let's fast forward. You're on stage at Device Talks, whatever, in 35. All right. What does the ortho industry look like? How do these technologies sort of play into all this? Because it's easy to say AI and machine learning, it's going to be a huge part of this. It's going to be a large part of everything. But specifically, how will that impact ortho? What will the process look like? And I'd like to just also unpack a bit or focus on the 12 minutes of time saved on the partial that... Because that's so important. That sounds like nothing. Well, it doesn't sound like nothing to most people.
It's a lot, man. It's a lot. I agree. Well, it's a lot. And the implications in those 12 minutes can be significant from an infection and risk standpoint, yeah. Having an exposure to the bone that opened that long. It's a big deal. So remember that. Let's start with 2035 device talks, and we're having a conversation, okay? Here's where I think we're going to be. The image recognition from x-rays and CT scans are going to get exceptionally good. And you're going to start to see the predictive capabilities there enhance and improve. Where that's going to help is in segmenting different patients to different procedures, whether it's a partial knee or total knee, or in my industry, that's what we're going to be looking at. If you look at structural heart, the orthopedics is a little behind. It's not just a little, it's a lot. Like I know where orthopedics is going because I started to see it in general surgery and other parts of the hospital. Orthopedics in this aspect, we're a little bit late to the game. That's why I can tell you with high confidence that this will happen. It's just a matter of time. I think from the segmentation and the diagnosis of a patient, we're going to start to see some pretty remarkable things. I think we're going to see some remarkable things during the procedure and anticipating steps of the surgery. We're starting to see that. We just launched a product called One Team, where we can see and we help the surgeon and the care team inside the OR understand exactly what's happening next in the procedure. And this is to enhance the efficiency. Those images that we take pre-op, I believe, will be overlaid into a system, whether it's, you know, One Team or robotics or any company will more than likely, if they're skating to where the puck is going, they will have everything integrated into a system where they know the size, and they might just validate during the procedure what size or type of implant that they may be using for this specific patient. The sensor technology will be activated during the surgery, and the enablement of that technology will happen immediately. And so where I think that's going to help is we're going to start to see the biomechanics immediately. You're not waiting for a visit to the hospital or the office 4 to 6 weeks later. You're able 2 to 4 to 6 weeks later, you're able to see it immediately as soon as they start to work. And where this is going to start to really dial it in is when you can not only see that, you can start to apply the population data where you can see, all right, what does surgeon A do that surgeon B is not doing? What does this patient population do that's doing so well do differently? How are we aggressively working the joint right off the bat, or are we letting it cool off for a day? Are we doing 1,000 steps, or are we doing 1,200 steps? Whatever, we will be able to diagnose and see what's happening. You'll also be able to see compliance of the patients. Are the patients moving? Are they doing what they're being asked? A lot of times patients will come into the doctor's office and they'll say, I feel like I'm not doing well. And they've built up a perception in their mind that they're not doing well. The surgeon will look up the our sensor technology today and say, you're in the 95th percentile. And we have not just the sensor that's inside the implant. We also have what we call MyMobility, which is a tracker on an application that measures basically the pedometer, like in the phone. So our system is able to analyze the movement of that patient. And it's getting better and better and better every single day. And so I think what you're going to see, Tom, is a predictive capability where at 2 weeks, you're going to be able to see potentially what should happen immediately if there's intervention required. More importantly, if somebody's doing great, they'll get a notification, you're doing fine. No need to come in. You can come in, but don't waste your time if you don't want to. And I think that's going to be the key, is bring up the surgeons to do what they do best, and that's operate. And not have to worry about the things that a machine could do better.
If I'm a patient, that's motivation for me to get the text like that to tell me I'm going to go back in and
you're doing great. Yeah. No need to come in. Exactly. Or you know what? Take a video. Let's look at it. I'm going to analyze it with a machine learning algorithm and get back to you and tell you, hey, I need you to do this exercise or that movement, whatever it may be.
Where do you think those surgeons will be, and where will these procedures be done? I know Zimmer Biomet's focused on the ASC market, as other med techs are. Do you see these new technologies, these new data interfaces, making the migration to ASCs, accelerating that migration, making it a better place for these type of procedures? How does that play out in your mind?
Where I see this happening is, it's the answer is yes. I think it's going to happen, and it's already happening in the ASC. There's a mass migration to the ASC, and anything that can help the surgeon and care team operate more efficiently in the ASC is going to be significant. Yvonne Tornos has given a vision for the four problems that we are solving, and we're aggressively focused on these four. The first one's awareness. There's 600 million people around the world that have osteoarthritis, and 5% do something about it. That's a problem. That means there's a significant amount of people that are suffering that could do better. And that was my mom. She spent years just dealing with it and avoiding anything because of the concerns with a knee replacement. Since she's had it, she has been very happy with what she's been given. It's a new lease on life, and she's able to enjoy life again. And I think there's a lot of people that do that. So awareness, safety, which is infection in for what we do. And we're very, very focused on this. This is how long the exposure is open, how long the bone's exposed to open air, for one. Two, are we integrating technology into the implants, whether it's with sensors or coatings, that enable us to see what's happening with that patient once the incision is closed? And so we believe that there's a potential to see what's happening with future iterations of sensor-based technology. Efficiency. We're not making more doctors or nurses. In fact, it's getting worse, as you know, and you probably hear this. And so there is a significant need in our industry across multiple specialties. It's not just orthopedics. It's every single specialty. How do you do more with less? And how do you help surgeons and care teams and facilities and payers do better with technology that can help that patient get up and moving faster? And so I think with efficiency and operational excellence and that focus on, like you said, 12 minutes means a lot. And not overlooking 12 minutes, not overlooking a minute. How do we cut out the waste inside of the operating room? And there's a surgeon innovator here in Georgia, just north of Atlanta, who is fantastic and a world thought leader with efficiency, Dr. Charlie DeCook. And he always talks about operational excellence and focusing on every single time waste in a day. And how do you operationalize it to where you're cutting that out and focusing on excellence? That's exactly where people should be focused. How do you do this and increase your outcomes? And if you do that, as an example, with the incision open less, you have less exposure. There's data that shows that the infection rate goes down. So we should be focused on efficiency. And then finally, outcomes. And this is something that every med device company is focused on. We are intensely focused on how do we ensure that the patients are getting better, that we're alleviating pain, that we're solving the right problems, that they're not Zimmer Biomet problems. These are the patient, the surgeon, the payer, the facility, every single stakeholder in this. How do we solve the biggest problems in orthopedic history? And you heard that at Device Talks of Tornos. It's being the boldest med tech company there is, focusing on the biggest problems that everyone else has ignored.
All right. Well, I think we've covered more than a lot. This has been great. And it's a day. We'll have Zimmer Biomet back. Device Talks 2035. Make sure folks circle your calendars. It's going to be great.
That's right.
All right, Joe. Thanks so much for the time and the vision today.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it.
All right, well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. Please subscribe to the Device Talks Podcast Network so you don't miss a future episode. Also, connect with me on LinkedIn. Connect with Chris Newmarker on LinkedIn. Connect with Kayleen Brown, our managing editor. Also, make sure you're following Device Talks. We'd love to make sure you don't miss our future episodes, our future messaging about our upcoming events, including Device Talks West, which is happening on October 15th and 16th at the Santa Clara Convention Center. Register for that at west.devicetalks.com. All right, folks, thanks again for joining us on this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast.